güzel mesela aşk var, sevgi var, neşk var, tutku var, yol var, yolculuk var, gitmek kalmak hepsi var, gün var, aydınlık var, sözünde hep durmak var, iyisi kötüsü hep bir yerde, sonunda bir hayat var.
Vom 15. Juli bis zum 18. August ist das Lora in der Sommerpause. In der letzten Woche von der Sommerpause hört ihr das Endlos Sounds. 120 Stunden Live-Musik aus verschiedenen Orten in Zürich und natürlich auch immer auf 97,5 MHz. Bis dann spielen wir euch die besten Sendungen vom letzten Jahr.
Tauchen wir ein ins Archiv.
36 Grad und es wird noch heißer.
Hello, Alan Masahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 89.7 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. Apartheid Israel's genocide continues non-stop throughout the occupied and destroyed Gaza Strip, killing over 48,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, including at least 11,000 unaccounted for, presumed killed under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. Over 85,000 Palestinians have been injured by the ongoing Israeli war crimes committed throughout the Gaza Strip since October 7, 2023. Every day, new videos are published showing the slaughter of Palestinians by the Israeli occupation army, shooting and murdering, execution-style, unarmed Palestinians in the streets of the Gaza Strip, including children, women, and elderly. Even those who have their hands up at the order of the Israeli forces are being shot and slaughtered. It is state terrorism in its highest form. In the occupied West Bank, the situation is getting worse by the second, with ongoing Israeli atrocities, incursions, destruction, and murder of Palestinians performed by the Israeli occupation army and their colonizers. Another video was just published showing an Israeli occupation force shooting an unarmed Palestinian in the street, and after he was wounded and screaming for help, they started shooting at him again and again with bullets until he was dead. And apartheid Israel continues to steal and grab Palestinian land throughout the occupied West Bank, destroying and demolishing Palestinian homes and kicking them out of their homes. It is ethnic cleansing that started over 76 years ago, and it's still happening to this day. It is Israeli state terrorism in its highest form, funded, supported, and protected by the United States, that grants apartheid Israel full impunity for whatever war crimes it commits. During the previous episodes of Arab Voices, I talked about and aired some of the remarks delivered at the World Academic Forum for Palestine Genocide in Gaza, held at the University of Houston in April 2024, organized by Scholars Against the War on Palestine. Today, I am going to air the remarks delivered at the Gaza Genocide in Context panel by Professors Osama Maqdisi, Abdelrazzaq Tikriti, and Avi Schleim. Let's begin with Dr. Osama Maqdisi, Professor of History and Chancellor's Chair at the University of California, Berkeley, who was previously Professor of History and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University in Houston.
I'm a professor here at UC Berkeley, which, as some of you know, is currently under investigation, not for the fact that it has been silent on the question of the genocide in Palestine and Gaza, but because students and faculty and others have been vocal in support of Palestinian freedom and liberation. So we're being investigated. I'm a professor of history here at UC Berkeley, and like all of you, I feel that we have a right to be angry, we have a right to cry, we have a right to be outraged based on what we have listened to, and what we've been witnessing. We have a right to be upset about the injustice and the genocide, by the double standard, by the silence, the complicity. But we also have a right to be inspired by everything we've heard before, by the people who've spoken before me, by the fact that Palestinians on the ground still persist in living and resisting, despite all the horrors that we've heard about today. What I want to make sense of today, most of all in the few minutes available to me, is the extraordinary situation that all of us, each and every one of us here today, finds ourselves in, which is to say, we are living in the face of an intolerable contradiction. On the one hand, there is a genocide that's being live streamed before our eyes, that some of the previous panelists have actually been involved in, have seen, have witnessed firsthand, but all of us have seen and followed for the past 6 months. On the other hand, we are living around us. There are people who are in active denial about this genocide. It's the most Orwellian, the most obscene, the most absurd thing that I have ever experienced in my life, this double reality. On the one hand, a genocide that the entire world can see. And this is the first genocide that I'm aware of in history that's been live streamed in this manner, that's been documented in this manner. On the other hand, there are people all around us who are participating in the genocide, who are covering up for the genocide, and these are people we interact with professionally, personally. The society around us participates in the genocide, and our government, above all, is actively enabling and funding and equipping and continuing this genocide. And so, it's this extraordinary situation of, on the one hand, an obvious reality, on the other hand, an obvious denial of this reality. So how is it possible that in the midst of this extraordinary live stream genocide, my university and virtually, as Abed mentioned at the beginning, every university in this country that I'm aware of has not taken a single public decent position on this genocide, condemning this genocide, yet virtually every university, including my own, have publicly come out several times identifying with Israel and condemning Palestinian violence. My association, to which I belong, the American Historical Association, was immediate in its condemnation of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And yet here we are 6 months into the most extraordinary genocide of our time, and not a word, not a peep has come out of the American Historical Association. So on the one hand, we know that Western governments are hypocritical and engage in a double standard, and there's racism, and that's the nature of geopolitics. On the other hand, we belong to Western academia, which doesn't, of course, challenge this order of things. It just polishes its most aggressive edges. And so on the one hand, we have an extraordinary, in the last 20 years in this country and in the West in general, an extraordinary culture of memorialization of past crimes, slavery, segregation, especially for universities like Rice and University of Houston and others in the South, where there has been an attempt to allegedly come to terms with the past forms of racism and slavery. And yet, when it comes to contemporary current genocide in Palestine, there's not only silence, there's complicity in this. So there's an active denial going on. On the one hand, there's no toleration whatsoever in American academia for anyone today who actively supports Jim Crow segregation or South African apartheid openly, and yet we have amidst us and around us in every university that I'm aware of, people who actively support and apologize for colonial Zionism. and for the Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. My own chancellor in this university publicly said that the Palestinian story is wrong. These are the words she used. She said, people may believe in it, Palestinians may believe in it, but their story of their politics and their history is wrong, whatever. And so the question for me then is to make sense of what does it mean to say that the Palestinian story is wrong in this moment? What does it mean that so many people who actively condemn slavery and racism of the past today are so utterly invested in either supporting colonial Zionism that is wreaking such havoc in Palestine today, or are silent and intimidated in the face of what is an obvious injustice and depravity? So there are several reasons I want to give in the few minutes left to me. The first reason, the most obvious reason, perhaps, is the material reason. In other words, there have been decades and decades of investment in the story of Israel, in pro-Israel lobbying, in donors, in people who identify with Israel. And they, of course, today put huge amounts of pressure on universities across this country and across the West, for that matter. And so there are material costs, of course, for taking an ethical position. But beyond the material costs, there's something fundamentally much deeper going on here, which is to say there's a history, a much older history of Western Orientalism, of Western racism, of Western demonization and ignorance of the Arab and Islamic worlds that is fundamentally much older. So it's not just a material question, it's also a question of culture. Culture, in other words, Orientalism, demonization, dehistoricization of peoples in the Middle East, and especially the Palestinians, because of what they represent in terms of an ongoing colonialism, and the victims of colonialism. A third part of the reason one is material, two is a deep sense of Orientalism. A third is more complicated, and this is probably what explains to me the extraordinary tenor of denialism all around us that makes no sense otherwise, which is to say that after World War II, and this is the history part since I'm a historian, after World War II in the West, and after the horrors of World War II, there was a philo-Semitic, and this is our colleague Daniel Cohen at Rice who talks about this, there was a philo-Semitic turn in the West. In other words, Western powers, Western countries, Western philosophers, Western historians, Western theologians, Western scholars, Western leftists, all sort of understood that the World War II and the carnage of World War II and the Holocaust and the obliteration of European Jews in the Holocaust needed some kind of new thinking after World War II. And so they came up with this philo-Semitic humanism, a philo-Zionist humanism that saw in Israel a recompense for the history of anti-Semitism in the West, and the history of the horrors, a partial recompense for the history of the horrors of World War II. But this philo-Semitic turn was conditional. In other words, European philosophers, historians, thinkers, writers, leftists, liberals, and others basically claimed to turn a page on Europe's and the West's anti-Semitic past. But at the same time, they generally refuse to turn a page on the Western history of colonialism and racism towards the peoples of the non-West. In other words, the continuation of colonialism, the refusal to deal with the history of racism, the history of colonialism, whether it was in America or in Europe, or of course in the colonial world. And so this bifurcation, on the one hand, claiming to be against anti-Semitism, on the other hand, claiming to not really deal with, or actually not dealing at all with, the question of colonialism and racism. There was a bifurcation, in other words, in Western humanism, which is why Aimé Césaire, the great sort of poet and the father, so to speak, of negritude, basically came up, condemned this as a form of pseudo-humanism. In other words, there was a hypocrisy, he said, deep at the heart of Western post-war humanism, which on the one hand claimed to atone for the histories of anti-Semitism, but on the other hand, refused to condemn the histories of colonialism itself. And they separated the fight against anti-Semitism from the fight against racism and colonialism in the non-Western, or against the non-Western peoples. So you add to that the fact that the Palestinians then are expelled from history, as Abed has said, at the same time as Palestine itself is destroyed, and as Palestinians are expelled from their homeland and from their lands in 1948. So Palestinians are decontextualized and dehistoricized. The whole history of Palestine as a place of coexistence, the whole history of the Middle East and the Mashriq as a place of coexistence is erased, is completely denied, and Palestinians are ejected from any sense of having a history of their own. So the only way Palestinians are made to fit into this Western post-war humanism is simply, as Edward Said says, in Orientalism, as a negative value. In other words, Palestinians, because they have no history, they're made to become a people without history. They're made to be a people without context. They're made to be a people without life, without love, without passion, without history, without meaning, without families, without archives, without anything that's important. They're simply cast either as nameless, faceless refugees who have to be clothed and treated as patients, but not as people. And on the other hand, if they resist this reality, they're turned into demons, and they're turned into a specific form of demons, a Nazi type of demon. And so in the post-war West, you have this sort of triad when it comes to the question of Palestine. You have this extraordinary narrative that gets built up after World War II. The West claims to be a force of good and morality because it fought against the Nazis on the one hand. On the other hand, it claims to have been the savior of the Jews and the Jewish people who were persecuted, which of course they were persecuted by the Nazis. And third, Israel then becomes the expiation. This is the representation of Israel, and this is of course how Israel represents itself, the expiation of the sin of the Holocaust and the sins of Western anti-Semitism. And in this sort of triad, Western saviors, Nazi evil, and the Jewish victims of World War II and the Holocaust, of which Israel then claims to be the representative, the Palestinians have no place. And when they do try to re-enter history, they're always represented as new Nazis because they oppose Israel, and in the West, Israel is seen as the recompense for the Holocaust. So the only way the Palestinians have in this Western narrative is to be and always to be represented as new Nazis, which then, of course, brings us to where we are today. After October 7th, what did Joe Biden say? He said that the events of October 7th, of course, he didn't mention history, he didn't mention context, he didn't mention the Nakba, he didn't mention 75 years of history and dispossession and exploitation and colonialism. All Joe Biden said was that the events of October 7th were, quote, as consequential as the Holocaust, which of course is absurd, but on the other hand, is extraordinarily telling because it tells you exactly how Palestinians are framed and fit into a narrative that then allows for their subsequent obliteration. Because the narrative and the racism of that kind of claim obliterates, of course, Palestinian history and justifies the obliteration of Palestinian humanity. It allows for the justification all around us that all of us, each of us sees in our own professional lives of people who think that what Israel did after October 7th was correct, was righteous, and that the Palestinians were evil, and Hamas in particular becomes like the new Nazis. It then explains also the deluge, the open deluge of hatred and the obscene U.S. and Israeli statements against Palestinians about erasing Gaza, about obliterating Gaza, about destroying Palestinians, about denying Palestinian civilians. And then finally, it allows for the reality that the doctors before and the panel before me, us, were talking about this horrific reality that the whole world can see. It allows people to see that or not see that. But to, even if they do see these images coming out of Gaza, in their minds, they put it in a context of saying, well, it's terrible, but this is what happens because of the fact that Hamas attacked Israel. And you start the story with the Israel being victims. It allows people who support colonial Zionism to not confront their own anti-Palestinian racism. And in fact, it allows them to not confront their own illiberalism and the racism of colonial Zionism. And it allows them finally to not see the perverse irony of where we are today, which is that Israel and the Zionists who support Israel have inflicted on the Palestinians everything that they genuinely, I think, believe was part of their own unique sense of victimhood, which is to say, the dispersion of the Palestinians, the diaspora of the Palestinians being made second-class citizens, Palestinians being subjected to pogroms, Palestinians being herded into ghettos, and of course, the Palestinians today being subjected to genocide. And the irony of where we are is that all this is happening at a time when the reality is so obvious. But unless we change the narrative framework, there's no way to actually have any of the testimony that we're giving actually have an impact on these people. The hope, of course, is not to appeal to these people as such, because I think at some level it's a lost cause. At a much more hopeful level, the appeal should be to the younger generation and to people around the world who do in fact see and have not been subjected to this narrative quite in the same way, which is to say that we see all around us today an extraordinary, momentous, there is a genocide, of course, and the horrors that can't be pretended away and can't be minimized. On the other hand, there is, without any doubt in my mind, a huge generational shift taking place right now all around the world, but especially here in the West as well, among the youth, that people who are seeing Palestinians for the first time within their own narrative, because of social media, because of the testimonies that people here in this room have provided, and the doctors and the journalists and the Palestinians, especially from Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem and inside and outside, are all providing. Each person is making an impact, and there's a cumulative effect that is taking place that is helping to reshape this narrative. So I'd like to end by just making the obvious point that, and to insist on where we're going, we have to keep providing witness. We have to keep providing and being voices in the wilderness. That means, of course, we have to keep arguing for and historicizing and contextualizing and humanizing Palestine and Palestinians, because we're not afraid of the past. We know that, we know the history, and especially the historians amongst us know this history inside out. We have to avoid, second, the self-censorship and the intimidation, because ultimately those of us in the West are privileged. In other words, those of us who are providing witness are in fact privileged people compared to the Palestinians inside. Third, there is, as I said, a generation change taking place. They are the future. And in a sense, all those who are advocating for Palestinian humanity are advocating for a future, because what's happening now is a complete realignment taking place. The Palestinian narrative, despite the genocide, is going to become inevitably part and parcel of what people and how people think about justice, morality, equality, freedom in the future. And so I'd like to end on that note and thank everyone, each and every one of you, especially my dear colleague, Professor Abed Takriti, for all the work that he's done in sort of advocating and organizing this conference. Thank you.
That was Professor Osama Maqdisi speaking at the Gaza Genocide in Context panel during the World Academic Forum for Palestine held at the University of Houston in April 2024, organized by Scholars Against the War on Palestine. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Next, we will listen to the remarks of Dr. Abdel Razzaq Takriti, Associate Professor of History and Arab American Educational Foundation Chair in Arab Studies at Rice University, who was previously Associate Professor and Arab American Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Arab History and Founding Director of the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies at the University of Houston. Professor Takriti also spoke at the Gaza Genocide in Context panel during the World Academic Forum for Palestine. By the way, he was one of the main organizers of the World Academic Forum for Palestine. Let's listen in.
This has been a very difficult conference to attend for all of us, I believe. After hearing what's going on in Palestine, and what's going on in Gaza specifically, it is difficult to come in and give a talk about history. But we must go back to history, because what we are seeing now is an internationally authorized and organized genocide. And the idea that I want to communicate to you today is that international authorization for the colonization and destruction of Palestine is a very, very, very old phenomenon. It goes back actually to the very beginning of the story of the colonization of Palestine. Perhaps what is unique about the colonization of Palestine, if we look at it in comparative settler colonial context, is that this was a settler colonialism that was enacted by an international order. Okay, most settler colonial cases are carried out by one country. It occupies a space. It authorizes the colonization of that space by a settler group, and it oversees that process. In the case of Palestine, it was a very late example of settler colonialism, and it happened in the context of the post-World War I settlement, where the League of Nations officially authorized the settler colonization of that space under the terms of the so-called mandate system. Let's consider the mandate system. In the Palestine mandate, Article 1 of the mandate was that the mandatory shall have full powers of legislation. This was fairly typical and administration. But Article 2, and that's the one that matters, says, quote, the mandatory shall be responsible for placing the country under such political, administrative, and economic conditions as will secure the establishment of the Jewish national home as laid out in the preamble. They laid out in the preamble the idea of creating a Jewish national home in Palestine, which means basically transforming a territory that was predominantly Arab into a territory that is predominantly European. Because what a Jewish national home meant at the time was the transference of Europe's Jewish population into Palestine. Quite simply. Forget about all the legal formulations. Forget about all the historic justifications. They had one justification for this: historic connection. There's many people who have many historic connections to many different parts of the world. That doesn't mean they could come and take the place of other peoples. And that was the argument that Palestinians said over and over again. And you know what? They're still not heard about when it comes to that argument. Now, this was authorized by the victors of the First World War. It was an international decision. When we use the word international, by the way, we mean the states that are in power. It doesn't mean that it's the peoples of the world. Peoples of the world were all under the boot of these people in power. They were four great powers running the world. And we still have this phenomenon now. The inequities in the global system are responsible. We're responsible for the colonization of Palestine back then and are responsible for the Gaza genocide right now. And we see this in the United Nations, the successor of the League of Nations. We see this in the International Court of Justice. It is not coincidental that it is a great African country that had witnessed a revolution, a sister revolution of the Palestinian revolution, that has come in to the aid of the Palestinian people at the ICJ. And it is not coincidental that all the sabotage that is done in at the UN and in the different legal spheres and humanitarian spheres and diplomatic spheres to try to stop the genocide from happening, all of this sabotage is done by the Western powers. What is their justification? We've heard it over and over again in this conference. It is racism. And I will illustrate this with reference to the man who set the terms of the mandate. I keep on repeating his quotes. I hate quoting him. He's a very terrible, evil man named Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, when asked why did he incorporate the terms of the mandate in 1922, why did he do them despite the fact that there had been two rebellions, Palestinian rebellions, that had been investigated by British commissions, and these rebellions proved that the Palestinians do not want their land to be colonized. His answer to the Peel Commission, which was asking him this question in 1937 about 1922, when the mandate terms were passed, was very clear. He said, I do not admit that the dog in the manger has the final right to the manger, even though he may have lain there for a very long time. I do not admit that right. I do not admit, for instance, that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, or at any rate, a more worldly wise race, to put it that way, has come in and taken their place. I do not admit